right, everybody. So today, back on the podcast, we have Cornelius Parkin. How are we doing, man?
Doing great, Dave. How about yourself?
I think this is your third time on the podcast. It might be fourth if we include the time with Scott, because you came on with Scott, right?
Yeah. I think this is the fourth.
Yeah. Okay. So it's funny. A lot of people know you, or at least knew you before, as like the guy who beat Boston Lloyd, right? And so.
Yeah.
It's weird to think that he, you know, because when I first came across Boston Lloyd, he was low 20s. I mean, this was like probably when I was in college, actually. And I think he's actually younger than I am. So he must have been 20 or something. And he was getting into these experiments super early. And it's sad, man. Like the whole industry, it's sad with stuff. I mean, it's still amazing to be the guys like, who's the guy, Dave Palumbo, will try to say some of these things are not caused by steroids or by, like, you know, these drug uses in general. And it's, I mean, especially somebody like him. I mean, you could argue maybe guys from like the golden era, who knows, but I would assume it still speeds up, you know, the process for them.
Oh, but, absolutely.
But guys like Boston and everything, it's just like, it's crazy to see that. And I don't know if that was like a delusional thing on his part, thinking that it wouldn't catch up to him, or if it was more like kind of like a mental illness where it's like, hey, I know it's a problem, but I can't stop, kind of a thing. I know you had some interactions with him.
Yeah. At the end, because obviously we had a little bit of a falling out after the show when he blasted me all over social media. But at the end, man, we probably talked once a month or so. I mean, great guy overall, family guy. He just had that OCD like compulsion to take drugs. I mean, he was taking a peptide which like kills fat cells, but has been shown to cause kidney damage and failure in monkeys. And he basically said, well, I'm not a monkey, so I'll be okay. And then, I mean, he took that and his blood work, his creatinine was like 6, like just terrible. And then in the end, he was, I remember him saying on some podcasts how he was like mainlining oxys with tap water, just like really not great behavior. Yeah. So it's sad, dude. Great guy.
Yeah, that is sad. And it's crazy what some of these like research chemicals people get into. And it's like, man, like, first of all, you don't have any idea if that's what's even in there, right? Like, we have this whole terkesterone issue going on right now where it's like, and it's like, you know, I don't believe, I mean, I don't know Derek from More Plates, More Dates, but I would assume that he didn't just choose to completely underdose it. Maybe it was an issue with, you know, the manufacturer or with the raw product. But really, you have no idea what you're getting, but especially from these research chemical websites. And then even if you did, let's say there was 100% purity in these products, most of them aren't that well studied. And it's just like, you have no idea. I always think of that. There was an episode of House, like the House MD from forever ago. Mm-hmm. And there was some episode where he gets a solution for his pain or, you know, his chronic issue. And then a new study comes out and it shows that it caused all these tumors. And so he has to go in and like get all these tumors out of him, you know, and obviously it's a show, but I'm just saying, a lot of these things you really don't know. And there's countless examples in medicine where a drug comes out, it was approved maybe a little too early, and then you find out later that there's all these problems. And that's with like FDA approved drugs, let alone these research chemicals. It's crazy.
It's true. I mean, it happens all the time. Think about any drugs. There were a lot of drugs that were used in the 80s and 90s, and now that's got all these lawsuits against them.
Yeah.
I mean, the research chemicals are crazy, dude, because based on what you read online from people who have tried them, it's not like they even do that much for anybody.
Right.
So it's like, I don't know. I think people just have a compulsion to take drugs. I mean, there's a couple of sites that sell these different things, and I've even seen like an injectable BCA product. I mean, why in the world would you want to
Right. Right. Hey, here's this useless product. Try injecting it as well.
So. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. It's a shame. I will remember, I've had John Meadows on the podcast a few times too. And I remember seeing a Facebook post where Boston had said something, and then John Meadows replied, "You won't live long enough to see that happen." And I don't remember what that was related to, but then obviously John Meadows passed away a little bit before Boston. And that's probably one thing I would want to point out. I understand John Meadows had a clotting issue and there was a history there. But I also feel like people are so quick to dismiss these things. Like, oh, it was this, it was that. Like nobody has 100% perfect health, right? You could always come up with something. But I do think it is an example just to understand that, I mean, you know, John was by all accounts a really fantastic guy, but also by all accounts, somebody who did care about his health, right? I mean, mm-hmm. I remember T Nation articles talking about eating grass-fed beef and these supplements to help and these, but at the end of the day, I mean, you can't be completely healthy if you're 5'7" and 240 pounds with 20 years of performance enhancing drug use. Like, it's just not, it's not compatible, you know?
No, I agree. And I mean, I think it was even over 20 years for him. I mean, every year bulking up, or even not bulking up, but doing the whole off-season thing mm-hmm. and then doing the contest prep. I mean, it's a lot on the body, man.
Yeah, it is. I mean, you know, and I think it's far reduced for naturals because you're just not going to be able to attain the same level of size, number one. And then two, obviously you don't have the drugs, but there's plenty of people who have bulked and cut naturally who will say, like, my skin is so much better when I'm dieting. My inflammatory markers are so much better when I'm dieting. And even that's why a lot of the health benefits from weight loss come from that first 10% or so. And you'd think, like, how is it just the first 10% if the one person is so much heavier than the other? But it's because there are things that happen from a calorie deficit itself. So I'm not trying to say you can live in a calorie deficit all the time. Obviously, I'm just mm-hmm. saying the act of, hey, I'm going to bulk up for 9 months of the year for 20 years of my life is maybe not ideal. You know, and again, I did it for 15 plus years. So I'm not saying don't go after muscle gain. I'm just saying you have to consider these things.
I fully agree, man. I mean, I think a lot of that is the inflammation you lose, right? The first 10%, a lot of that is just going to be bloat and inflammation. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, dude, I mean, it's hard to know because you see those studies of, like, natural bodybuilders who have dieted down, and it's not like they get out of it, like, scot-free. They have, like, negative changes in their blood work, too. So,
you mean, like, the contest lean?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't say that's healthy either, right? I mean, to go like that extreme. But now for somebody like you, who obviously you're a very big guy, you're, I forget stats, is it 5'9", 5'10", 240?
5'8". 5'8". Okay. I'm like, and this morning I was like 237.
Okay. So, I mean, yeah, obviously you're huge. So do you think you would try to downsize it all in the future? I mean, you said you're 36, right? So it's not mm-hmm. like you're old. I mean, probably, and a lot of people talk about in their 40s downsizing, things like that. Do you see yourself going that direction?
Honestly, man, I mean, I won't say I started downsizing, but when I was like 25, I was really into like the hardcore bodybuilding. I had got up to 255 and I was having a lot of like sleep apnea issues. I just felt terrible, tired all the time.
Yeah.
So after that point, I was like, I have no need to be any bigger because being a pro bodybuilder, I mean, I like how the bodybuilders look and they love to train, but for me, that doesn't have a special allure to it. So I guess you could say I'm starting to train a lot of jiu-jitsu, and the size definitely is a negative there.
Yeah.
So yeah, I would say over time,
from like a cardiovascular conditioning standpoint, it's a negative.
Yeah, because especially if you don't stay super relaxed while you're doing, you basically just pump up after like about 40 seconds. It's just, it's ridiculous. Yeah. It's a unique feeling.
Yeah. I have a few people who DM me and they say, I always talk about jiu-jitsu and I should just do it, but I'm still holding out. We'll see. But I know a lot of people love it.
Oh, you should, dude. It's like the most fun I've ever had. Like, it really is. As long as you go to a good school where, you know, they don't just beat you into the dirt.
Right. But I thought you get that training at home, don't you? Rather than a school?
No. So there's a school literally 1 mile up the road. And my daughter's trained there for 2.5 years and she's one of the instructors. So we're there for like nearly 3 hours, 5 days a week.
Oh my God.
And yeah, up until recently, the classes for adults were like at 7 p.m. Mm-hmm. And for my schedule, it just didn't work to, you know, do all that with her, come home, get ready, and then go myself again. Yeah. So I was just doing some privates, the occasional Saturday. But now they're lining it up that there's adult classes at the same time as the kids' classes. Mm-hmm. So that'll be nice.
Did you say 3 hours, 5 days a week?
Yeah.
That's a lot of time.
It is.
Wow.
It is. Like, so it's a couple of days, it's only 2 hours, 30 minutes, but yeah, 3 hours, because she teaches two classes first, the younger age groups,
wow.
and then she has her own class. Yeah.
Oh my gosh. That's awesome.
Yeah.
So Yeah, I mean, it does seem like a cool endeavor to get into. Now, as far as the like the size, I've heard other people talk about that with other, like there's a point where, you know, people talk about back in the day, even football players weren't weight training. And then once everybody started weight training, now it's the norm. And in general, I actually just heard this in MMA recently where some of these coaches weren't having them do any strength training. And now it's more and more popular. But it does seem like there's a point where you just kind of are too big and it just exhausts you earlier. So are you finding that there are, I mean, obviously it's going to depend on skill as well, but are you finding that there are smaller guys who can take you on, even maybe at like a similar experience level, just because they're not so big, or does your strength kind of counteract that?
No, like if they're the same experience level, if they're, you know, like white belts or that, I find I can just physically overpower them, to be honest.
I would think so.
Yeah, but the higher belts, mm-hmm. Yeah, they just know all the techniques, and yeah, I get wiped out within like 30 seconds.
So. Really? I've always wanted to do that, just go against somebody who's like very high skill, but like 140 pounds, just to see it. Not because I think I would win, but just curious to see like that level of skill. You know, I'm always fascinated by very high level athletes, even if they're like, I played racquetball, for instance, with a guy who was ninth in the world at the time. And it was just amazing. Like even something like racquetball, to mm-hmm. see somebody generate that much force as with such a small body weight, it was just incredible, you know? And so obviously jiu-jitsu even more so.
Well, so much of it is, you know, technique and drilling these specific movements. So you can be standing up with somebody 1 second, next second, you know, you're on your back and you're in a choke.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's interesting, but I like it because it's kind of the opposite of weight training hard. In weight training, you're kind of really trying to push as hard as you can. But on jiu-jitsu, you're really trying to stay as relaxed as you can. It's more of a thinking game than anything.
I do see that. I see that some guys rolling and they're just very methodically moving slowly, trying to like, and like, it's weird because in one sense, like they're trying to strangle each other to death. And in another sense, they had this calm face and they're just like, I'm going to go here. I'm going to kind of twist this way. It is very interesting.
Yeah, it's a unique thing. I really like it. It's like the intelligent man's fighting, if you will, because you're not punching each other in the face, you're not kicking each other.
Brawling. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, none of that. So yeah, I would definitely say give it a try, dude. It's really good.
So in regards to traditional weight training, and you know, you mentioned how it's like you're just going all out. And I think probably the program or method that goes with that is DC training. And that's something I've talked about a number of times on the channel. I've talked with Dante here and there over the years. And, you know, I've said before, we don't agree on everything, but we agree on like the main principles. And you were saying that you were surprised that I think you were surprised I talk about it maybe, or that I've done it much. So kind of elaborate why you're surprised there.
Well, if you look at your guests, you have a lot of like very science-based people on, which is awesome. I enjoy hearing those episodes and I like reading those papers. But if there isn't that much evidence really for a DC approach, is there really? If you look into it, I mean, how many natural guys who have built, like I go now to the gym, Crusher Coliseum, it's Doug Miller's gym.
Oh.
So like the world's best natural, he's a super cool guy. I mean,
is he in North Carolina? I didn't realize that.
Yes, he's in Statesville. So he's like 20 minutes above where I live. Okay. It's like a semi-private gym. Like as long as you message, you can come and train. But I'm a member there now. It's like the best gym I've ever been. They even have an extra room with like this huge, it's like pictures of gladiators and stuff on the wall. Like it's really cool.
Okay. Yeah. So anyway, go ahead.
I was going to say, like, if you watch him train, he trains, I would say like high volume, plenty of rest between sets and just like heavy, but dude, he trains for like 2 to 3 hours every day. Yeah. When I come in, he's training. When I leave, he's still training.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. That's so interesting to me. Cause I just had Jeff Alberts on and we were talking about this, how it doesn't matter how long you do this, you hear other people doing a certain method and you're just like, oh, maybe I should do that. Like he, who's been doing this for like 30 some years, heard Jeffrey Berry Schofield talking about his high volume arm training. And it even made him think, oh, maybe I could do that. You know, you have to step back and realize maybe not. And same thing, like I will hear that and I'm like, you know, and then there's this evidence that it should be higher volume and the studies do show that. And then I'll remember, okay, I've done a million high volume experiments in my life. I've done unilateral training and specialization phases. And like, it just didn't matter that much. So like, you know, I think it's cool to get excited about it, but in regards to the evidence for something like DC training, I agree with you for the most part. It's funny because I'll see Dante sometimes post a study, and this is where we'll disagree on some things, and we'll say, oh, here's this calf training study. See, I was right all along about the stretching. And it's like, dude, like that study was just stretching. There was no control group where I still haven't seen this. Actually, Eric Helms, hilariously, Eric sent me an email the other day. And he's like, hey, here's this calf training study, you know, and it was basically saying, because he knows about my experiment I'm doing. And the thing was, it was this device that kept you in a stretch for a long time. I think it was like at least an hour per day. But there was no control group. So yeah, the group saw calf growth, but it's like, but how does this compare to training plus the stretch? And I've never seen that study. They same thing with like blood flow restriction. Like, okay, people say, well, it showed just as much growth as regular training. Okay, but where's the study that's just training versus just training plus blood flow restriction? Because there's a million things. I mean, running could induce muscle growth for some people. It doesn't mean that that's the best thing. So I think a lot of these studies, I mean, I made a post about this as well a week or two ago, like how many just ridiculous studies there are where it's like, how was this even approved, or how is this designed, or how is there this much time and money going into this crap study? Not that all the ones I just mentioned were bad, but it just in general. So the point is, I've seen Dante post some studies that to me, I don't think validate the method, but I do like that he talks about, again, of course, progressive overload, very intense training, more frequent training. Although it's funny because, you know, he comes from an era where, and maybe you a little bit, where it was like, it's you're training each body part once per week, right? That was like kind of like the norm. And he would say, well, if you train it every 4 or 5 days, it's higher frequency, which ironically nowadays, nobody would consider that high frequency, right? Nobody considers training a muscle group once every 4 or 5 days. Now it's 3 times a week is high frequency or more. So all that to say that I think it's a great method because it gets a lot of these people who are focused on volume and fluff and all this stuff to worry about, as he calls it, heavy slag iron, right? Moving like these heavy weights and progressive overload. And I think a lot of people could benefit from that. But I'd have to agree with you that it doesn't really comport with some of the literature now in terms of rest times, in terms of frequency, in terms of total volume, or even protein requirements, right? I mean, he talks about 2 grams per pound. Very few people actually recommend that these days.
That's a lot of protein.
Yeah. I mean, I was 17 years old at 160 pounds. My parents, like, you're eating so many chicken breasts. You know, I was eating 320 grams of protein a day. It was ridiculous. It was like all protein. And very few people recommend that these days.
I agree, Duke. I think the training methodology, it's great. And I mean, I the theories behind it are very sound. I was just saying, for you, it seemed like a little bit, it was kind of unusual to me that you seem to be so strongly attached. You mentioned DC training a lot, is what I should say.
Yeah.
And I mean, it's good, but I feel like, you know, there's this talk about, oh, you don't want to do too much volume and you don't want to do fluff exercises. But then if you look at a lot of these guys who just do this DC training, like my friend Jordan Peters is an example, always doing this really heavy lift, or Dusty Hanshaw. Mm-hmm. If you look at their physiques, they're very, very large, but they don't have a whole lot of detail because I think they're just building their prime movers up so much that the smaller muscles, I mean, you can see yourself, just like look at the back picture of one of those guys. It's like a big slab of muscle.
Yeah.
And there's not, I'm not saying as in detail within the muscle, which some people say. I'm talking about like clear separation between the muscles.
Hmm. So you think maybe that's due to the methodology, like they're not growing some of these smaller muscle groups, essentially?
I absolutely think that, because there's so many different exercises and angles. Like, I've had a problem with my right hip. And it's an issue for jiu-jitsu. What it turned out, I did some PT sessions, is my inner rotation muscles, it's weak on my hips. So there's some muscles that are underdeveloped. And I've always done quite a wide variety of exercises, but obviously not enough. Not enough single leg work, not enough Copenhagens, you know, just not enough. So I'm saying with the DC training, I feel like, and any training that super focuses on a few compound lifts, I just feel like you're going to end up with weaknesses within your physique. And also, I mean, dude, you can only get so strong.
Right.
I'm not really like I was very strong. I was a world champion as a teenager in powerlifting, but I'm not really, I've never been really any stronger than that.
Yeah.
I mean, so at a certain point when you're deadlifting like 500 pounds for 15, I mean, what's the goal? To go to 600 for 15? I mean,
right.
Sure. But your connective tissues can only take so much. I mean, I've torn my tricep and then in turn my pec. So
yeah, I remember you saying that.
Yeah.
So have you done DC training and fortitude training? Or either one?
I have. Fortitude training I really enjoy.
Yeah.
Because that's really, it gives a big mix of stuff. I did DC training a few times over the years. Like first time when I was 19. And I really liked it. Honestly, some of the best growth I had would have been back in 2008. And we were doing, me and my training partner, we were doing DC training. But dude, we were training like 5-6 days a week. Yeah. So we would just keep repeating. So the volume was actually, you know, it was higher. That frequency was higher. And it worked really well, at least for a good period of time. But then the injuries start happening, or a training partner gets injured. I mean,
yeah. I'm a big fan of fortitude training as well. And again, it's not because I had some amazing results in fortitude training. I just mean it was fun. I think if you haven't read the book, I do recommend people read it because it's a great book in general. He goes through a lot of studies. There's a lot in there on the nutrition. It's a great book. But it's not like I saw such amazing results. I mean, I've said this many times on the podcast. I don't think there's that many routines where it's going to be so dramatically better. I think there are better and worse routines, but I don't think if you did DC training for a long time versus 4-2 training for a long time versus, I don't know, insert generic bodybuilding routine, it's that much different as long as those other principles are there, meaning the nutrition and the sleep and the progressive overload progressively eating more. But it's interesting to hear you say that about the DC with the development, because he does actually even more so than I would put an emphasis on exercise variation, right? Because with DC training, you're selecting three exercises per muscle group to really progress with. And then on top of that, when an exercise stalls out, you rotate it. You pick a new exercise. So ultimately, I mean, you could be going through 5 or 6 different exercises for a given muscle group. So it's interesting to me that you think there'd still be some.
So my argument would be like, let's say you're rotating your shoulder exercises. Generally, they're going to be like a compound pressing motion. I mean, that's in the, you know, in the two-way split, that's what they focus on a lot.
Yeah.
Why wouldn't you do some side delt work or rear delt work? I just don't buy into the idea of doing some side and rear delt work will overtax your body so much that you're now no longer growing.
Gotcha. Okay.
The fortitude training
isolations.
Yeah, I mean, just a little bit more of a holistic train everything to a certain degree approach. And the fortitude training I found is very good for getting you. Like, I got leaner within a couple of weeks of doing it, just from stimulating the whole body. Yeah, I noticed that my caloric demands did definitely go up more than I thought they would, to be honest. So I found, but it's also exhausting training, dude. I mean, after one of those sessions, I really struggled to, you know, be productive for the rest of the day. So,
yeah. Well, I will say when I did fortitude training, he's got like tier 1, 2, and 3.
Mm-hmm.
And there was this guy on one of the forums who was just like, I don't know, sometimes like the ego on some of these bodybuilders, because Scott specifically talks about like starting low and working up and everything. But this guy's like, I've been training. So he went right into tier 3 turbo with the max number. And I'm just like, okay, like, these are the same guys who shit on younger lifters who don't listen to their coaches, who shit on younger lifters for like switching routines all the time. And yet you got an extremely experienced, knowledgeable bodybuilder saying, do it this way. And you're like, well, I'm just going to jump to the edge because I know better. I've been training for all these years. Like, all right, well, whatever you say.
Yeah, you see that. You see that a lot for sure. I honestly, you know, I've done the tier 3 turbo and I've done like the tier 1. Honestly, I didn't find that it got, I didn't find tier 1 that much easier than tier 3, to be honest, because what's the big difference? Like on the leg compound on tier 3, you're doing 2 sets not to failure, and then you're doing the 1 set to failure. You got the set for hamstrings, you got the set for quads specifically, while in tier 1, it's just like 1 set for all, each one of those.
Yeah.
But that's the failure set. And isn't that the hard set, you know, for quads, the hack squat where you go to failure? That's by far the most taxing, I find, anyway.
Yeah.
So the my point is that tier 1 is still very taxing. I think people underestimate how much work that is.
For sure. You mentioned, you know, you said you can only get so much stronger. And I do hear this talked about, but in another way, it's funny. I'll hear both sides talk about it. Somebody like Dante will say, you can only add so much volume. What are you going to be doing? 30 sets, 40 sets, et cetera. And other people say you can only get so much stronger. So what are you going to be lifting 500 pounds for reps? Like, no, like you're going to do this or that. And so the reality is, I think it's that, look, you can't do either forever. If you look at most advanced guys, they tend to settle somewhere between 10 and 20 sets per body part. You got maybe like a Doug Miller is doing more, but rarely do you see consistently doing more than 20 sets per body part per week. Alternatively, you're right, of course, you can't gain strength forever. However, to me, that is almost synonymous with saying you can't grow forever, meaning, of course, you won't get stronger forever. But to me, if you're not getting stronger, you're probably not growing that much. Now, I think you might be a counterexample there where you're going to say you were lifting super heavy, I think you said in high school. And obviously, yeah, you've gotten way bigger than that. Yeah.
But I think a lot of it is, I think people really understate the importance of, you know, people make fun of squeeze the muscle and the mind-muscle connection. But at the end of the day, I mean, what are we doing but stimulating our muscles? So it's super important to really lock in and work the muscle instead of just moving weight. So you'll have two people, both, let's say, pressing the 100-pound dumbbells for 10. One of them is really actively contracting and stretching, and the other guy's just moving the weight. I 100% think the first person is going to have more growth in the muscle doing it that way.
I agree. But if you're able to control the weight like that, it's because you're stronger, right?
Yeah, of course. Yeah, I would agree. But I'm sure for you, there's a weight also where it feels like you are just moving. It's like you are moving the weight. That's what you're doing, compared to you're contracting your muscle and you're using the weight to add tension to the muscle contraction.
Yeah, no, I agree. But like, so I think of that exact example because there's a video of me, I mean, I was probably 22, and I did 100-pound dumbbell shoulder press for 10 reps. And, you know, I kick it up and I'm just like going like this, and, you know, and then I have a video, I have two videos actually since then, much older and a little bit bigger. And I'm trying to do it with better form. And the whole video, like there's all the setup and I pick up the weight and I sit down and I go, and I 100 pounds and I kick it up and I go, and then I can't get it up. And because I'm starting all the way down here and I'm trying to do, you know, good pristine form. Yeah. So if I were to do 10 clean reps now, it might be, I don't know, 85 pounds, for example. Mm-hmm. But again, I'm just saying, if you're equating form, I do think you have to be stronger. This was actually something I don't know. It was a weird argument I had with Dante that I don't even think we were arguing. I think we were just saying different things. And it was to talk about exercise variety. So I definitely am interested to hear if you agree with this. So my argument was like, let's say you have a hammer strength chest machine and you can do, let's just say 300 pounds for 10 reps. And you go up and it goes, 310 pounds, 320 pounds over, and you get to eventually 350 for 10 reps. But then it stalls and it stalls and it stalls. And then a lot of people say, well, switch the exercise. And I would say, if you go then do another chest exercise and you do that for 6 months and you progress and everything, if you then go back to the hammer strength chest press, you haven't done it for 6 months. So maybe you're going to be a little bit weaker, right? Maybe you're back down to 330 for 10. My argument was that, to me, until you surpass your previous 350 for 10, I don't think you've really shown that you've grown much. Meaning, if you've truly gained chest muscle, like pectoral muscle, there would be more mass, meaning more contractual fibers, meaning eventually you should now be able to get up to 360 for 10, 370 for 10. If you go back to that exercise and instead you find that you still get to 350 for 10 week after week and you never surpass that, my opinion is you haven't gained any significant amount of muscle, because if you had, you would have gotten stronger after getting reused to the exercise. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that does make sense. Yeah.
So you agree or no?
I guess it depends. What else are you doing in that workout? I don't see where I differ from, I guess, the whole DC thing is, I don't think you're going to it's not like a light switch, like a lot of, like Mike Mentzer's old thing was like, you turn the light switch on, right? The one set it gets it growing. I don't know if that's necessarily true. I'm like, I think you need a variety of stimulus to really maximize hypertrophy. So, I mean, what you're saying makes sense, and you probably would be about as, I don't think you're going to lose a lot of strength gains on a hammer press because that's a fixed machine. So right. You're not going to use the stabilizing muscles as much. So, I mean, I can see your point, and I don't necessarily disagree with that, to be honest. I think if you said the same for, let's say, a bench press, then, yeah, we got all the neurological changes that we got to take into account.
Yeah.
So you're going to lose a lot of that. I know that for myself. If I haven't done certain compound lifts in a while, my strength is, you know, it's down, even if my muscle is different. And, you know, in 3-4 weeks, it comes back.
Well, that's what I'm saying, though. I'm saying after the adjustment period, because I totally agree, especially... And I use hammer strength because it is kind of fixed, but
yes.
But even if it is a bench press, like I'm actually dealing with that right now. So my best bench press was 225 for 16 reps. And that was like pre working with Steve Hall. So yeah. We do all this other stuff or whatever. Well, I didn't bench press at all because I wanted to take the ego out of it. So I didn't bench press for 7 or 8 months. So okay. Now I'm getting back into bench pressing. And the first time I bench pressed after all that time, it was like 225 for 6 or something. Like it was like dramatically less. And then the other day I did, I think 12. So to me, if I don't get back past 15, then it's like, well, I didn't gain it. Like over time, I didn't gain muscle, in my opinion. But so, if I go ahead.
I've got just a generalized question for you because I've noticed I've watched the videos about the Steve Hall coaching, and you said you didn't make a whole you didn't really make any progress. So you kind of you enjoyed the training. It was extra work, you know, so time efficiency wasn't really there. But did you do the same thing with your nutrition, or how did you approach the entire picture with that?
Yeah, well, and honestly, this is what's so fascinating about it. And it really underscores the difference between doing what's best to make the gains versus maintaining. Because because you would think that, so I went from intermittent fasting, which I had done for years, to eating throughout the day. So 3 meals a day, I bumped it up to 5 meals a day. Sleep was always constant, like 8 hours a day.
That's good.
I went from 3 days a week training, low volume, to 5 days a week training, moderately high volume. What else did we do? You know, adding in significant isolation exercises that I wasn't doing before, like basically trying to make everything there happen. And you'd hear that and you could say, how could that not result in progress? And I always say, it's not that I don't think that would result in progress if you were like intermediate. I think that would be a faster method of progressing than what I'm currently doing with 3 days a week and the intermittent fasting and all that. But to me, once you've hit that cap for yourself, I don't think a lot of these things matter anymore. So I always say, like, if you're listening to this and you're 2 years into training, 5 years, whatever, don't just assume, hey, 3 days a week training is necessarily optimum for me, or intermittent fasting and not even 6 hours a day. I'm just saying that once you're there, I found it doesn't matter all that much. I mean, even John Meadows talked about this. He was like, you know, he had a period where he was eating 100 grams of protein per day and he didn't lose any size. But I very much doubt that John Meadows would say to eat 100 grams of protein per day to maximize growth.
I fully agree with that, man, because over the last 2 years, my training has been, I mean, it's been pretty sporadic, to be honest. I focused a lot on my businesses. I had several periods of time where I didn't work out for weeks. And did I lose some from my, you know, where I was, let's say, in May of last year? Sure, but not nearly as much as I would have thought. And that's even eating, like, people wouldn't believe me when I say, but often eating only once a day with one shake.
Yeah.
And just working for the rest of the day. Like, I dropped initially in the first 6 weeks about 10 pounds, and then it just kind of stayed there.
Yeah.
And then as soon as I started training, I just kind of went back to where I was before. And I'm like, I'm currently trying to get really back into the train. Now that I'm going to this gym, it's very inspiring to see Doug and some other people there. I'm going to train with him in a few weeks. So I'm building myself back up. But dude, like the training I do at the moment, I just do like giant sets with like barely any weight. Like if you saw the training, you'd be like, that's not going to do anything.
Yeah.
But I'm just like squeezing, contracting with one plate and another exercise and just until I have like a maximal pump. And for me, that it gets the muscle back, and I've actually been really surprised by it, to be honest, because I used to really believe that, you know, if you don't train for a few weeks and stuff, that you'll really regress a lot.
And,
you know, in my 20s, I had like a paranoia in my early 20s when I was really hardcore into bodybuilding. Like I wouldn't miss a meal by more than 15 minutes. Looking back, I'm like, yeah, because I can relate with the intermittent fasting stuff. Yeah, it's like you lose a little fullness and then it doesn't really go anywhere.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you only have to look around at like some of the like weekend warriors to see this. Like I have most of my friends took it really seriously in high school, college, and a little bit after college. And now, man, like they'll stop working out. Like my brother still has 90% of the size he had when he was taking this really seriously. And he literally barely lifts. Like his legs are the same size as mine. Like he's clearly not where he was. So I'm not trying to say that, but
no, I get you.
But it's fascinating how quickly it can come back. And actually, even from like a life standpoint, I think people like us and probably most people listening to this would have a hard time accepting this because we always want the most. But if you really try to think about like, you know, the best way to go about life, like almost like a video game, if you can max out different stats, right? If you can get each one to like 90%, it makes more sense than putting 99% on one and then everything else suffers. So there's absolutely an argument to be made for, okay, put everything into this for like 10 years, get to 95%+ of as big as you're going to be, and then maintain that on like 2 or 3 days a week. And then, you know, from a health standpoint, maybe you should exercise more, but like, and then focus more on businesses, focus more on this, focus more on that, because you can maintain it. And that doesn't just apply to muscle growth. That could apply to business in general, right? If you work your ass off through high school and college and you can get into a career, a lot of times, you get to a point where you can kind of just coast, but you have a really good income and good lifestyle because you worked to get there. And I know Mike Isertel has talked about this too, and probably would agree. Like there is a point where it's like emotionally, you don't want to step back, but logically it could make sense to put that energy into other things and try to max out those areas of life.
I agree. And that's why I like jiu-jitsu. It's such a good challenge for guys who have trained for so long because it's a physical challenge and in a way it's still a very masculine, energetic, you know, you're literally rolling with somebody on the floor, but you have to completely change how you approach it compared to, let's say, a max set of squats or bench press. You know, it's so much more thought has to go into it, and you have to see your body like a gas tank. Like every movement costs a little bit of your gas tank, so it's really like you're playing chess, which I really enjoy to play myself, but with people.
Yeah, I agree. There's something very masculine about just being between another man's thighs and just, you know.
I mean, it's very roll with women too. I mean, that really is an ego buster when you get beaten by a lady. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. No, I'm sure it is. So I agree though. I mean, it just makes sense to try to like do other things. And I don't get me wrong. I still struggle with this, right? Like I'm still very engrossed in like the fitness world and listen to, you know, research reviews and everything. And I like it. Like it's an enjoyment thing too. So I just mean, you know, if the day comes that like I have a family and I need to like back off a little bit, it's not like it's going to kill me to then have to, hey, I'm going to do 2 to 3 days a week for a little while. You know, I think that's reasonable.
But you also have to take into account that training is like your time. And you, even if you're busy throughout your life, you still need to make time for yourself. That's something I ran into the last few years because I was like, I'm just going to put all my effort over here. And then you end up neglecting yourself. And, you know, that's not great for the psychological or physical point of view. So when people say that, I'm like, yeah, okay, maybe you can't go to your favorite gym 5 days a week. But there's no reason that you still can't get in some kind of workout, be that at your house or jiu-jitsu or whatever. I think it's important to not put yourself on the back burner, so to speak, even when you have these other things to do. But I agree with what you're saying, and I would 100% agree that if you stop enjoying the training and that's no longer a source of enjoyment for you, then absolutely I would cut it back. You still should do it because you want to keep your body in good shape, but yeah, you wouldn't want to put as much effort in anymore.
Yeah. Do you have a home gym set up at all?
I actually do have a pretty good home gym set up, and I like training in it sometimes, but honestly, I enjoy the social of being in a gym. I didn't realize I enjoyed it as much as I do. So yeah. I do sometimes train, and I've got like dumbbells up to 150. I've got like, it's a good setup.
Yeah.
But yeah.
Yeah. The social aspect is a big thing. Cause I, up until college, I was very much like, you know, I never wore cutoffs. I put my headphones in. I was just like, you know, to myself. And then I met the bros at the gym, and then it like, but it was honestly, it was way more fun. Like after I opened up to that idea, And because I was in university so long between college and dental school and all that, I really got to enjoy that environment. And the last couple of years, just going to regular commercial gyms, it's not quite the same. You know, if you're in a university, it's like everybody's kind of doing what you're doing, right? Yeah. Whereas you go to a regular gym and then, you know, so many people from different walks of life. So I've got a few close people at the gym and I like that social environment, but there are definitely times where I'm like, I would rather just be home, do my thing for an hour and then like just move on with what I'm doing.
And I think for you, you have a lot of social interaction with your everyday life.
Right.
But I think for me, I'm talking to people all day, but I'm doing it on a computer.
Yeah.
I only really see a lot of people when I go to a show, which I did a week ago. Mm-hmm. That's only there, you know, otherwise I don't really see a lot of these people in person. So right. Going to a gym, even if I'm not really a big talker at all while I train, just being in the same area and saying hi and then bye or whatever, I find it gives a certain boost to the motivation and just feel good.
Yeah, no, there's definitely something to that aspect too. And even just like, you know, you have those people who you have like a friendly competition with, right? Where it's not like always comparison, but just like, hey, you're doing this, I'm going to do that. So I think that's a good thing.
Yeah, absolutely, it is.
So I want to try to find that comment where, because we were talking about ab training a little bit, and I don't know if I'd be able to find like the exact one, but you were saying that you do like to do direct ab training. Is that right?
Yeah. So I've changed my opinion on this over the years because like I don't need to train my abs to have a very visible six pack because the muscle is there.
Yeah.
For instance, I had a client that competed at a show, his first ever show. He's just turned 50 years old. He's a competitive jiu-jitsu and judo athlete. And dude, the level of definition he had in his core blew everybody in the show away. Like it was just, there was just more going on. It was like, I can send you a picture sometime. I mean, it's just, there's a lot. Yeah, there was a lot more going on there. And I really started to think about it. And I'm like, unless you're doing very heavy oblique work, I don't really think it's going to increase your, I mean, it might slightly increase it if you're taping it, but visually it's not going to make you look blockier, I don't think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was what it was. We were talking about if it would make you blockier because Dante has actually said, he's like, why do these competitors do all this oblique training? Like, don't you see what happens to older guys with their blocky waist? This is exactly the opposite of what you want to do. So at least as far as I'm aware, the last time I've seen him comment on it, he was against oblique training. When I was young, I just wanted abs. Like that's like all I cared about.
Yeah, me too.
And I definitely have a blockier waist. And so because of that, I have shied away that and the fact that I just genetically, I do have blockier abs. So I don't, it's not like I need to do it so much, but could they grow? Probably. And I just didn't want that blocky waist. And this is where I think it could be interesting in terms of like a true competitor versus somebody who just wants to look good.
Yeah.
And the reason I bring that up is because in your example, that person who had that great development, they are on stage shredded, right? Mm-hmm. But it's almost like what I've talked about before with pro bodybuilders. If you look at some of these IFBB pros, even at 12% to the average population, they can look obese in clothes.
Oh, yeah.
Right. Even though on stage when they're shredded, it's like, wow, nobody would ever say they're fat. In person, in clothes and the higher body fat, not even high, just in not shredded body fat, they can look kind of overweight. And by the same token, I would wonder if this guy with this amazing core you're talking about, if he was 14% body fat, would he actually look worse because of all of that abdominal muscle? I don't know. I'm just speculating because
I'm just going to say that often when you see these guys, it's not really the muscle thickness that's looking bad. It's the fact that their stomach is bloating out, right? I mean, that's usually the issue. It's not like if you can suck in and have a completely flat stomach, it's rare that you'll go, okay, unless you're Jay Cutler and like he's a unique individual, how he's just built.
Mm-hmm.
But just in general, these loose waists people are talking about, I mean, that's from years of drug use and overeating, and you're just stretching everything out. So then when you relax, it looks like a turtle shell hanging out. I don't think it's really the ab development in that case that is causing that. I would say if anything, doing like stabilization and inner core work would actually help keep it tighter for a lot of those guys.
So you're specifically talking about like the abdominal bloat or like the GH gut, which I agree with you for sure. But I'm even just talking generally, like even somebody who doesn't have it, like quote unquote GH gut going on, I think to the untrained eye, a lot of these guys have bloated faces and just being big. A lot of people see just size in general. A counterexample would be like Jeffrey Verdi Schofield, where he naturally has a very tiny waist. So even when his body fat is higher, people see, they see silhouettes, they see shape, they see all of that. And so they see a tinier waist. And honestly, like there are a lot of women like this where I've seen women who have higher body fat percentage, but they're just blessed with this hourglass figure. And I've seen girls who literally have six packs, but they just have an unfortunate, you know, for them shape, and it kind of hurts the physique. I'd even go so far as to say, I know, you know, there's like the first step where girls get worried about gaining too much muscle, right? And then there's the next step where people say, oh, you're not going to be too muscular. And I agree with that for the most part, but I actually have seen girls who, from a purely aesthetic standpoint, maybe have too muscular of an overbody compared to like what a lot of women would want. So I don't think it's always the case that like, oh, you're not going to be too muscular. Like I absolutely know women who are more muscular than most women would want to be, if that makes sense.
Oh, dude, like my family, we're all kind of, we're shorter and more muscular people in general. Mm-hmm. Like my aunt, she had to stop weight training even in her 50s because her arms would just look too muscular for her small frame. Otherwise it would look like,
right,
like gorilla arms on this little woman.
Yeah.
So yeah, I mean, it certainly can happen for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. So, and again, I hope nobody listening to this is like, oh, women shouldn't weight train. Not at all what I'm saying. But the point is, it can totally happen that they, compared to what they would find ideal, they might get too muscular.
Agreed. Yeah.
And then the last point I would make on it is one of the comments you made, because you were saying, do I think the obliques would actually grow if I were to train them, given that I say nothing grows anymore? And that the counterexample I gave was that, like, look, I didn't train my neck directly for, you know, the first 15, 16 years, but it doesn't get that much stimulus so that when I did direct neck training, I gained an inch. And I wouldn't be surprised, I should say, if that happened with oblique training. If I said, I'm going to start directly training my obliques 3 days a week, I wouldn't be surprised if they did grow. And I just personally, with somebody who has a kind of blocker waist, wouldn't want that.
Yeah. And I mean, it would only have to grow a tiny amount for you to notice it. So I don't disagree with that at all.
Yeah.
I just think in general, I think training the core, maybe not with heavy side bends, but even like hanging leg raises to stretch it out. And then you're just getting that mind muscle connection, or planks even. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you're not good at planks, I mean, you're shaking after a minute or so, even on a basic variation. So I think it's useful to do some work for it, maybe not even every week, but just occasionally.
Yeah,
making sure you get some stimulus in there. I mean, yeah. I get both arguments though, for sure. And I mean, if you have naturally a blockier waist, you're probably, you know, you see those people wearing the waist trainers and that stuff. So I mean, yeah, I mean, if you're going to go to that extreme, then you might as well not train your obliques, for sure.
Right. Yeah, I remember seeing one guy posting about how he wore his lifting belt like basically 24/7. I mean, all of his waking time, and he just like cinched it really tight. And he actually said that it seemed to reduce his waistline. I would wonder about that, if maybe it's just more keeping you tighter and keeping your stomach in. Although I do know there's anecdotes of the women with like the really crazy waist trainers that it does make a difference, but then you're like smashing your organs together and whatnot.
Yeah. And I think maybe, sure, you will get less stimulus in that area because you're basically compressing it the whole time, but then you shouldn't do any compound lifts either. So you see a lot of people who do that and then they're still loading their spine. And it's like, you're kind of defeating the point. Like when I downsized and did middle weights naturally in 2014, I was well aware that I needed to get my waist as small as possible. So I only trained on isolation machines for like 3-4 months.
Really?
And my waist did come down. Like I taped around the belly button at like 28 inches.
Wow.
And now if I'm in shape, honestly, it's 31, 32. So
at a similar body weight, or that's now?
No, different body weight. Now it's heavier. But when I was coming down to get that like illusion of the small waist, so to speak, I stopped loading my spine. I stopped doing bent over rows, anything that would take my core to stabilize, basically. So I just did different machines, isolated. And I think I definitely lost some muscle because I was in shape in the low 180s, but I wanted to get down to 176.25. I did DEXA scans. I literally remember one DEXA scan. I lost 5 pounds of weight and I dropped on the DEXA scan 0.3%. And you can say a DEXA scan isn't totally accurate. It's not, but it's got great repeatability, and I definitely had lost like tissue.
Without a doubt. Yeah, it's interesting to see just obviously the correlation with body weight in general. I mean, when I was, I don't know, 130 pounds, and I probably had, I think I had a 29 inch waist, and like I could be contest lean right now. I wouldn't have a 29 inch waist anymore. You know,
yeah.
When I get lean now, even it's probably, I could probably get it down to like 30 and a half, maybe if I was like contest lean, but at some point I'll notice I'm getting leaner, but the waist just doesn't keep getting smaller, you know, at some point for me. But yeah, it's amazing when I see some of these guys like Jeffrey Verdi Schofield or Paul Canoe, and it's like 28 inch waist. It's just like this crazy taper.
Dude, it's all genetics. And I mean, as far as that goes, and your point about the women, I saw that like last weekend. I had one client, she actually turned pro yesterday, so that's great. But she's 52 years old, super jacked. And she lost the overall in it. Like the overall was won by this girl who has amazing shape, but she was still like, I don't know, 20% body fat. Like there was a clear layer of body fat over her entire body.
Really?
When you looked at her in person. Yeah, but then when she got on stage, dude, her shape was just crazy, nearly cartoonish.
Really?
Tiny, tiny waist flaring out. I mean, a figure especially, it's shape first, everything else second.
Yeah, that's actually, it's funny because we were talking at a bachelor party this past weekend, and most of the people there lift, and we were saying like, you know, it's like what is natural. Like I don't personally care like about what is officially natural or not, but we were saying, I said like, would you consider if a guy got like calf implants or pec implants, would that be natural? Would they be allowed to compete in a natural organization? Because you know that the leading question there goes into, well, women have breast implants and they're allowed to compete naturally, and somebody said, well, but are they even judged on that? And I would say they certainly are judged on that, because in reality, like they look at poses, and many poses are going to be accentuated if they have these fake breasts compared to if they're just completely flat because they're so lean.
And but what I would also say to that is you see a lot of lady competitors who have very large implants, and it throws their entire look off. Like that way too top heavy. I mean, if you look at any, especially, I think it's less common with the younger women now. I think a lot of younger women are going for smaller implants. I was literally discussing this last night while I was watching the Team Universe videos. Like a lot of the younger ladies have smaller implants, while some of the older ones still have these huge implants, which does, it makes it look a little funky at times. It really does. But I would agree with you that, I mean, aesthetically, it does help. But a lot, even if you don't have those, the way the suits are made, I mean, it doesn't make as big a difference as people may think.
Really?
And especially, yeah, and especially if the implant is over the muscle, dude, it doesn't necessarily even look that great. So, I mean...
Yeah, it seems like that's not nowadays. I know they do, like, the under the muscle. But it's just interesting that it's, like, it's so... It's almost ubiquitous within the competitive culture to have implants. Like I had a friend back from when I was in dental school, and she ended up competing. And like, again, one of those people who just blessed shape wise, and like within a year, she just actually, I'm pretty sure she's an IFBB pro after her first competition. But she was very flat, and then she got implants, I think pretty much like for the sake of competing, and you know, her shape and everything looks good. It's just interesting that it's, as far as I'm aware, you can compete naturally with breast implants. I have no idea if you can compete naturally if a guy had, again, like pec implants or calf implants or anything like that.
That is an interesting thought, Dave. Yeah, I'm not sure. I mean, in general, on those ladies, you're not judging their breasts so much while you would be judging a guy's calves. So
right. And then that's what the person argued. But again, you also aren't, like when you judge, it's not like, okay, you get a point for like pecs and you get a point for calves. It's like front double bicep, right? Most muscular. So it's an overall pose. And I would argue then that like the overall pose is influenced by the individual muscles, you know, together. And by the same token, I don't even know all of the women's poses, but I would imagine that the judge is probably looking at like, how does this look on the whole? Right.
Yeah.
And then they're going to factor in those shapes. So it's just interesting. I'm not saying there's a right or wrong, but
no, I would agree. And I would think if you are that way inclined that you want to compete specifically in a natural contest. Yeah. I mean, implants seems a little weird to me, to be honest.
Yeah,
it just does.
Right.
I mean,
right.
It's not a natural thing, is it? You're influencing how you look. you probably can do it, but the question is, should you do it? And are you portraying this, the right message? I don't know. You're portraying the message of, I don't use anabolic steroids or PEDs, but you're still having a surgery. Like my wife, Nicole, she had to have her breast implants taken out. What was it? About 5 months ago or so, because they were recalled, and she was having like those like chronic fatigue and all these issues.
Yeah,
and they did go away after she got them out, and quite rapidly, to be honest.
So she had silicone.
She did. Yeah.
Was it silicone outside and inside, or just because I know there's like various types?
I honestly don't know the answer to that, Dave. I'm not sure, but I know she had them taken out, and she had been suffering for the last couple of years, just like generally not feeling the best.
Yeah.
And she got on this kick where she thought this would make a big difference, and there is actually like a before and after of her face.
Mm-hmm.
And her face, you know, this is just when people say that, you never know how seriously to take them, and there could be other factors involved.
Sure.
I get that, but just from my point of view, seeing her, it did seem to make a positive difference to take them back out.
It's amazing actually how much I do hear about that. So my cousin competed, and she has breast implants, and you know, she's a nurse practitioner, and she's like, oh, you know, that's BS and everything. But it's like, yeah, but like, you obviously have an extremely strong bias towards wanting that to not be real. And I think 10% or more of women who get them end up having them removed. I know Mark Lobliner's wife just had them removed. And again, like you said, I'm always skeptical, because it's like, you know, oh, they're suddenly feeling so much better. It could totally be that, or it could be because there's a placebo effect. I mean, it's very hard to know. It but is. There are enough reports where it's like, it seems like there's something there to the, to the extent that, again, not knowing that much about it, I think as like a general recommendation, I might say they have non-silicone ones, right? Just like water-based ones or saline-based, that maybe if you're going to get it, go that route, obviously do your own research on it, but at least then you don't have that same potential risk.
I would agree fully with that for sure. And I mean, because it's like a certain period of time goes by. I forget if it's like 7 or 8 years.
Yeah.
But it lined up. So she had it about 10 years at that point. And she had been noticing like negative changes in how she felt for, I mean, it was a couple of years. We never really pinpointed it as the implants. It was just, she wasn't feeling the best a lot. And she'd have more infections, and she just wasn't doing as well. And then once she did get them out, within months and weeks even, she was like feeling a lot better and less health issues. She had to take a break from training. Like, we train hard, and after about 3 weeks, she'd be so worn out, she'd usually get like a little sick or something and have to take a week or two off. She's been able to train. Yeah, now she's been able to train consistently, like every workout that I do. So, I mean, is there something to it?
Do you think, because this is something I remember asking Jeff Alberts about, like, he's got a, I think, 10-year-old son, maybe 9-year-old son, who's doing karate. And I said, is he getting into like the bodybuilding, like the lifting stuff? Do you think like having a kid of your own, you might even steer them away to some degree, like seeing that like it can be almost a toxic culture if taken to the extreme? Or do you think you just kind of let them figure it out on their own?
Yeah, I'm probably going to give you the absolute opposite answer, but I do the opposite. I have her like doing weight workouts together. She's even allowed in a couple of the gyms we go to, she's allowed to come and work out. She comes and trains. I don't take it like super. I don't make her take it super seriously, but it's definitely helped her when she rolls against boys who are, she's literally beaten 13-year-old boy before.
Wow.
So, and like, he's a lot bigger. She's not very tall or very heavy. So, I mean, it definitely does help. And I would steer her away from getting into like the toxic influencer culture, which so many people are getting stuck in now, because you have your body that can be, it can be a marketing tool, it can be an asset, or you can just degrade yourself to the point where you're just putting up pictures of your near naked body for likes.
Yeah.
And then you're getting unhappy. I even have clients that say, oh man, I only got X number of likes on this post, I don't know why it is. I'm like, dude, it's got nothing to do with your content. It's the algorithms. I mean, there's so many factors that play into that. You can't you can't judge yourself worth the number of likes you're getting.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I don't have kids, but I would imagine it's hard for me to imagine having kids that aren't involved in lifting and just being around me lifting and things like that. Not that I would force it on them, but I imagine that would be a culture of my household. But exactly like you said, I would want them to be into that aspect of it. In sports, I think there's a great community in a lot of sports, but the whole influencer aspect of it is, I think it's almost like, I'm glad, I know people always say, oh, I'm glad I didn't grow up when this thing was happening. But I look at things like TikTok and whatnot, and it's like, it's almost hard to imagine being a teenager now and not constantly comparing yourself to like the top 1% or something of people, because that's all that's glorified on these things.
No, it's a huge issue. And you have a lot of teenagers like taking a lot of drugs to look a certain way. You see it all the time, like these really forced looking young bodies. Is like, you shouldn't have like a purple head when you're like 18 years old. I mean, you should never have that, right? But you, especially at that age, I mean, when your body is the most resilient, what are you doing to yourself exactly that you look that way?
Yeah.
So yeah.
Yeah, it's a weird culture. I'm glad I'm at least removed enough from it where I'm, or I should say I'm old enough where it doesn't bother me if it, like you said, if there's not a ton of likes on something I post or there's not the constant comparisons. But I think it's something to really watch out for.
Yeah, but I wouldn't even say it's your age, man, because I know people who are in their 60s who do like bodybuilding and stuff still, and you can see how dependent they are on that validation they're getting from that. Yeah, it's like, it's really pathetic to see, to be honest. But yeah, I do see that.
Yeah, so. No, that's true. I saw, obviously I won't say who, but I saw Facebook. Somebody posted on a Facebook and they were like, well, I'm pathetic, I'm going to do this, and like going on this date. And they were like 40 something years old. And I was like, and this is like 5 years ago. And I was like, how are you posting this as a 45 year old? But I guess people just don't grow out of it.
Yeah, it's weird behavior. But yeah, I think it goes beyond a certain age. Some people just get stuck in that thought pattern.
Yeah, for sure. All right, man. Well, we're a little over an hour here. I appreciate you taking time. It's always good to talk either in DMs or here. One of these days, I'll get that road trip going. We'll work out. Maybe I'll peep into Doug Miller's gym there.
Yeah. We'll work out there together. It's an amazing gym. It has more equipment than any gym I've ever been to.
Really? Well, yeah. I'm always glad to be the smallest guy in the room. So at least I won't be the shortest, right? That's one thing with bodybuilders. Right? So
yeah, you definitely won't be the shortest.
Right. All right, man. Well, thanks again.
No problem, dude. All right.